Hi, welcome to this week's edition of Education Transformation, hosted by Lee and Kate Ridge. This week's topic is on the importance of trust. Normally, Kate would be introducing our podcast episode. However, at the moment, she's really quite sick, so it's down to me to take on this responsibility. So today, we're talking to Dr. Lou Mycroft and Dr. Christina Donovan. Lou and Christina have recently been part of a collaborative project exploring the role of the advanced practitioner in facilitating quality improvement processes across the further education sector. This interview was so rewarding, there is considerable content that ran well over an hour, but it was very difficult to cut and to edit because the content was really that relevant and that important for the world in which we live with regards to the vocational education sector at the moment currently and the challenges that we all face globally. So we've decided to break this episode into two episodes that will feature back to back over the next couple of weeks. In the episode, Christina discusses a recent paper she published with regards to distrust being a traditional aspect of most adult education institutions. And we speak about how can we combat those issues, how can we address those challenges in a really positive way. There are some wonderful examples presented by both Lou and Christina in relation to allowing for professional space in which to practice our craft of teaching in a safe environment. And by doing so, we're building trust collaboratively throughout various campuses and institutions. Dr. Christina Donovan is a lecturer in the Department of Children, Youth and Education Studies at Manchester Metropolitan University. Her research interests include trust, organisational leadership and management, cultural change, youth transitions and adult education. Her doctoral work focuses on the importance of trust in the interpersonal and organisational processes. She previously worked in the further education sector in learning support, pastoral care, and student voice. Dr. Lou Mycroft is a researcher, writer, and educator. Starting out as a community worker in public health, she spent nearly 20 years in adult community education before taking flight into a nomadic life guided by affirmative ethics. Her recent PhD involves the creation of a community education imaginary. She is co-founder of the Joy FE Collective and co-organiser of the Adult Conversations campaign. She works on national professional learning programs in the UK for adult educators, including AP Connect for advanced practitioners. Lou is a thinking environment practitioner, bringing people together equal as thinkers. Some of the discussion points we talk about includes the distrust that is often associated within adult education, how to build trusting relationships throughout faculty groups, the importance of co-production research, and the importance of self-care. These two podcast episodes will prove to be very constructive and practical as they help us on a day-to-day basis in our roles of adult educators. So Lou and Christina, thanks so much for joining us for this really important conversation about trust within academic relationships.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. It's really exciting to be speaking to someone across the other side of the world.
yeah, excellent. So where have you both been working and what research have you recently been undertaking?
I can go first if that's all right. I currently work at Manchester Metropolitan University as a lecturer in education studies. But my background has been working in FE, so I spent a number of years working across a few different colleges in the northwest region of England before undertaking my PhD, which started in 2015. So my research, and since I finished my PhD, has been about making sense of trust culture and trust relationships within the sector, and I guess for my interest in trust is related to how we can foreground the emotional impact of working in cultures that sometimes don't work or that neglect relationships or ignore the values that bring us to work in this sector in the first place, I guess. And our latest research project, which kind of builds on some of that work I started in my PhD in lots of ways, is about how we can foreground those values in order to start building trust cultures back into our working practices.
Mm-hmm. Very valuable. What about yourself, Luke?
So I am a nomad. I work as a freelancer now. My background is coming through public health community work, working in adult and community education for 20 years at a college with a social purpose education message. I guess the field that we're working in here is what you guys call VET. For us, it's FE, further education, adult mm-hmm. community education. And I work a lot on professional learning programs sponsored by the government, the UK government. And I do an awful lot of community building work across the sector through a movement called Joy FE. And Christina and I met, years ago. So we've sort of been hanging on her coattails with this trust journey, just waiting for the opportunity to do some, research with her and with practitioners.
Wonderful. So there's a good bond there, good professional respect.
Absolutely. My acknowledgement of Christina in my PhD that I recently finished was that she's not cited more often because her work is everywhere in mine, and that's the absolute truth.
I absolutely feel the same about Lou. I think Lou's also in my acknowledgements as being the person that really encouraged me to get my PhD finished. We met very kind of serendipitously in a way, and we found that our values really spoke to each other, and it was always speaking with Lou that reminded me why I was doing what I was doing.
That's lovely. Yeah, fantastic. Very valuable. What is Joy FE? Do you want to take a moment to explain that?
Yeah, so Joy FE is not the work I get paid for, and it's not the professional space that Christina and I are going to talk about, though many of the people are in common with that. But right back at the start of lockdown here in 2020 in the UK, and we have been more or less locked down ever since and only just coming out of it, I got a call from a friend, Steph Wilkinson, who said, people are going to be on their knees, let's do something. And we started Joy FE as a hashtag community. We would call it a collective now. No money, no hierarchy, no management. I mean, deliberately those things. Just a group of people who affiliate around that hashtag, digital magazine, broadcasts. One of us has just launched a radio station called Joy FM. So lots of stuff going on to build community in a very rhizomatic sense, so that you don't have to sign up or join. You can just come along to something and be part of it. It's been amazing.
Great. Good on you. It's amazing the positive stories that are coming out of COVID-19. So the resilience and the innovation within people is fantastic. I've just been recording a interview with some stakeholders in Vanuatu, actually, and they speak of some tremendous innovative ideas that they've brought about through COVID-19. So yeah, it is. It's a great opportunity to share some of those developments. Lou, what inspired you to move into adult education?
I was a community worker, and so it was almost a drift. I worked out in the community for the NHS, our National Health Service, not as a clinician, but as a community development worker. And I got the opportunity to be honest, got myself in all sorts of hot water, because I went to the community and said, what is it that you want to campaign on, a health issue? They wanted to campaign on the fact that their local hospital was being closed down. I helped them organise that campaign, was not popular with the employer. So I'd been doing some work with the Northern College, which is an extraordinary institution in the north of England, which was set up to provide a second chance at education for working class men and women from the surrounding industrial areas, which is where I live and come from. And so when they started a community regeneration program, I went along there not even thinking about myself as a teacher, just thinking of myself as a community worker to help pass on and share skills. The program was, again, funded by the NHS. It was called Community Health Animateurs, where animateurs were activists. It was a European Union project. And and it was amazing. And when the money started to dry up for that, because it was European funding that then was directed elsewhere in the union, as it should have been, I drifted into teacher education. But the teachers who came to me were people like me who were community workers and, you know, who were doing a social purpose program of education. And that social purpose has always been really at the heart of my work and developed into the values work I do now and the trust work with Christina.
Fantastic. Wow. That's pretty inspiring. That's wonderful. What about yourself, Christina? What's your story?
I guess my experience of finding further education or adult education as a career was very accidental. But I think that's a story that's very common amongst people that end up with a career in further education or adult education. It seems to be the kind of sector where the career finds you rather than you looking for it. So I started working as an hourly paid education support worker in a college in the north of England. And I guess that sense of being, you know, I started my career in 2010, when, you know, that was when, you know, a lot of big cuts started to be appearing and a lot of cracks started to appear in the sector itself. So I entered into a sector that was already almost defined by precarity. And I'm sure that that's something that we might return to when we think about how that shapes trust relationships. But I essentially collected a number of hourly paid contracts before finally securing my first full-time contract in a further education college. And I started off essentially working in support services. So I was working with students who had been identified as at risk for whatever reason, and I was essentially supporting them from a welfare perspective before I ended up coordinating the student voice work within that college that I worked in. You know, I ended up moving on to my PhD as a result of being made redundant. So, this is something that really has defined my career in FE. But the reason I stayed and I continue to try to stay for so many years was because when I got there, I just fell in love with that sector. I just saw the work that we were doing and I stayed to continue that work. And I hope that in the work I do now, I am still continuing that work in some way.
Yeah. Wonderful. You're right, aren't you? That statement of how the profession finds you is represented in many, many people and their careers. It's often not intentional. It just seems to evolve around us. And also the need or the inspiration that when people become redundant or when careers begin to change, things happen around us, that a lot of people move into further education and deeper learning to evolve and to develop further. And it really does produce some of the best outcomes in many people's lives. So thank you for sharing that, because I think that's pretty profound. So let's move on. Christina, what is, and I'm going to ask you both, but Christina, maybe if I start with you, what is co-production research?
So co-production research is something that's quite new to me. It's something that I started looking into for the purpose of the research project that me and Lou started to do together. And I'm going to use the word stakeholder, and I hate the word stakeholder, but essentially working from the perspective of co-production when designing and planning research and undertaking research is that all those who have a stake in the outcomes of research should also have a stake in its design and development. So as an underpinning principle, the outcome of a co-produced piece of research should be of value to those who are part of producing it. So when I was developing, you know, the framework, I guess, for how we would approach this research project, it's about meaningful engagement in knowledge development, and it challenges this assumption of the expert researcher. and it recognises that knowledge is produced collectively, and it privileges how knowledge is produced through collective action. So within a co-produced piece of research, we understand all participants as part of that research have their own knowledges that they bring to that environment. And so within our project, we tried our best to make sure that everyone had the opportunity to engage with the research on an equal footing. We use something called a research circle approach. And we essentially viewed knowledge production as a process of knowledge building that was as a result of dialogic engagement of between a group of people that brought different levels of knowledge and expertise to that group. And so the outcomes are produced from the collective.
Okay, so dissolves the expert researcher. That's quite interesting. I'm actually studying a university subject on research at the moment. So so you've given me a little bit to go away and scratch my head over, so I will. So thank you for that. What about yourself, Lou? Would you like to add anything?
I think for me, it's the anti-competitive element that, as a practice principle, further education, adult community education in the UK is very much built now along marketized lines. The language of it is very much businessy. So you might have a business partner, even within the college, you do business planning. There's a competitive element, and that's not what we need right now. It's not what the world needs. Yeah. Anti-competitive practice is part for me of I've been really thinking and reading and studying anti-fragility as a way of being in the world, thriving, not despite of chaos and change, but because of it, finding the you know, the sort of skills, energy and connections to help you work through that. So if it almost like, I'm not going to use the business word agile, but if you imagine the sort of buildings that are built to withstand an earthquake are built to move, aren't they? They're not built to be sort of solid and standing still. And anti-competitive practice is massively part of that with me. Part of it comes from that background in community regeneration, when all of the European regeneration money came into my area of the world, it was a bun fight. It was a gravy train. And when that money started to be withdrawn, the competition became quite vicious in some cases, to be honest. And, you know, that was a lesson for life for me, really, that I've taken with me. So one of the things we, the way in which we worked is that we all would record interesting encounters, critical incidents or, you know, experiences, resources, and we would share them on an open source platform called Wakelet. And then when we met again in the research circles, we were expected to have looked at everybody else's and we would just discuss what our freshest thinking was. We wouldn't be, oh, you know, I've put five things up and you've only put one thing up. It just like was so much not like that. Yeah. And so what happened was our relative, the hierarchy, we made the hierarchy invisible. We put it to one side. We said role, rank and ego left at the door. So it didn't matter what role people were in their organisation or even within the project, because I was the lead. Christina was the lead researcher, but we all got stuck in together. And that was a marvellous experience. And the light bulb moments came from every one of us, really. So what we came out with at the end was genuinely a reflection of all of these people and their thinking and their experience on the project. And, you know, research can be called consultative or co-productive and often not be that. And this really was.
Yes, yes. Research circles. Yeah, I like it. Yeah. I like it. Have you noticed, I mean, I commenced in the year 2000 into adult education. And again, I never had any intention of doing so, but that's just how my career evolved. But in that 20 years since, I've seen a significant transition from perhaps the valuing of high quality education outcomes and more of a focus upon generating of finances through education. And I'm a bit uncomfortable as to whether the two can ever really mix. What are your thoughts on that?
Shall I dive in first? Sure. I've got to believe that they can. Otherwise, there'd be no point. I'd be off doing this work somewhere else. I would love to completely rewrite adult education from the bottom up, and that's my research, my PhD research. Where we are now, I think there is an opportunity that we've been taking in the last year to focus on practices and processes and not just the whole outcomes focus thing. So even in the way that we ran the project, and this was a, you know, this was a significantly large government funded project as a whole, of which the research, the co-evaluation was just one part. We have KPIs, you know, we have to show value for money, but we were able to negotiate those KPIs in a very loose way, so that actually the program, particularly during a year of, you know, catastrophic change, was able to develop and emerge and be led by values, so practice values. So not what do we want this to look like at the end, but what are we going to do along the journey? How are we going to make this a practice of care, a practice of joy, a practice of solidarity, equality? And I think there is the potential for that practice-led, values-led approach to work to some extent within the marketized framework. It's not easy, Lee, is it? And it, you know, there are always going to be challenges and tensions with that. So that for me is why the skill set changes. And the skill set becomes one of using your influence, potential, if you like, to be able to perhaps from a lower position in the hierarchy, still be an agent of change. And that, because the people at the top don't know how to do other than what they do. You know, they are the people responsible for balancing the books. And what we've seen in further education, adult education, over the last couple of years, really, of the project is that change being really driven from the middle. Look, we can show you how to achieve X, but we can do it via Y. And that's proving really powerful.
Yeah, well, that's inspiring, Lou. I like that. That's refocusing me. So thank you. That's fantastic. What about yourself, Christina? Did you want to add anything to that?
Well, you're actually touching upon a conversation that I was having with our very lovely colleague, Dr. Colin Forrest, last week, and we were discussing whether outcomes and values exist on a spectrum or whether they're independent of each other. And it's partly for a project that we're currently trying to seek ways of taking this work forward. And we were thinking about how you could create cultures in which values and outcomes can be valued equally. And what is the impact upon an organizational culture when we prioritize one over the other? So I would say at the moment we do operate in a very high risk, highly marketized system, which encourages that competitive practice and very individualized practice. And my research very much sought to address the impact that has on our identities, which, you know, I very much think that links to the phenomena of burnout in lots of ways, the drive to practice in such a way that doesn't sit with our own personal professional values. So I would say we're currently in a situation where within organizations we value outcomes very highly, and we are always working towards very specific outcomes that are often not always of our choosing. And values as part of that process are currently not valued in the way they should be. So I guess when I think about the work that we've started together, it's about how do we write values back in to those organizational cultures. So that speaks very much to what Lou's been talking about there. And and for me, yes, we will always need to work towards KPIs. There will always be specific outcomes that we need to work towards. But how would those outcomes change if we also wrote values into the mix? Would we change our priorities in different ways if we actually were operating and were held accountable to our values.
Yes, yes, yeah, good points, good points. Great wisdom from both of you. Thank you. It's probably a podcast episode in itself, but we shall move on. Christina, a recent paper that you've published suggests that distrust is a traditional aspect of most adult education institutions. Do you want to just take a moment to describe how distrust is embedded within institutions?
Well, I think we've already started to touch on that in the conversation we've had so far. And I guess the paper that I wrote was specifically looking at the UK policy context, but the more people I speak to, the more I see that there are, you know, there are similar trends happening in other countries as well. But I think the essential problem I was trying to address when I was writing that paper is that where you have a system, well, particularly in the UK, which is highly competitive, but also with this toxic coupling of also being quite precarious, where funding is always... it's always relatively sparse, but also the conditions for that funding can change on a regular basis. What you find is that organisations are responding to those policy requirements by having to negotiate greater and greater levels of risk. And so when decision making becomes very centralised like that, where you do not necessarily have, you know, local control over the outcomes that you're working towards or the KPIs that you're working towards as conditions of funding, etc., then that creates the need to control the individual at the organizational level. So where you have greater freedoms, so-called, you also have greater risks and the greater need to control the outcome. So we operate within cultures that need to be able to predict the future in that sense. So when we work towards outcomes, we're constantly trying to predict what the outcome will be, and we need to be able to control that outcome as far as possible and therefore write out risk. We're very risk negative within our institutions. And so you've also got that coupled with a post-compulsory sector in the UK, which is quite complex. It straddles a lot of different priority areas. And it's shaped by a lot of competing policy interests. So an increasing focus of adult education funding and further education funding on skills for work, for example, or targeted support for 16 to 19s, or the narrowing of the adult education curriculum, means that much of the sector becomes unavoidably, outcomes driven. Yeah. And so because we're constantly trying to control outcomes, it means we're also directing behavior, and it also constrains the extent to which educators in their practice can experience agency and experience a level of control over their work. So I guess the central claim of that paper is that those levers of government, I guess, all work to constrain the practice of educators, and that puts a lot of pressure on relationships. So where we're quite risk negative and there are really high levels of risk, that need to control or predict the outcome is actually the antithesis of what trust is. Trust is about letting go of the outcome. Trust is about hopeful action towards a positive future. When we take the decision to trust, we kind of let go of the outcome to a certain extent. And that's necessary to embrace that vulnerability, to be able to place faith in another. It requires being risk positive rather than risk negative, I guess.
And I guess there's a balance there, many new educators would arrive hoping to make an impact and to have some sort of control over their curriculum that they're developing and teaching with regards to their perspective. But if that's being controlled by quality standards and alike, and there is a need for that, of course, but it can reduce enthusiasm and perhaps enhance burnout over time. Would that be a reasonable thought?
I would say that in relation to burnout, when working with participants in my research, and also from my own experience, and I'm quite explicit in the first part of my thesis, and I talk about how this research very much is linked to my own identity as someone who used to work in that sector.
Yeah.
That the experience of not being trusted is really painful.
Mm.
And when people say, I don't feel trusted to practice in the way that I would like to, and we feel that our behavior or our practice is being shaped by forces almost beyond our control.
Yeah.
We're actually required to step outside of our identity and step outside of our values. And that can be a really painful process. And so I do think there are links between living distrust, I guess, in your practice, and feelings of burnout, because you're not driven by your own intrinsic values and motivation to do the work that you guess that I guess brought you to the sector that you work in and to do the work that you do.
Yeah, that's right. So Lou, what are some of the benefits of trust within the workplace? Obviously we've just spoken there about some of the negative consequences of not having trust within the workplace. But what are some of the rewards and benefits of trusting relationships?
We've really seen this over the last year. The group of educators that Christina and I have been working with on the co-evaluation are known in England as advanced practitioners historically, and they are in a role where they perhaps are involved with coaching and mentoring colleagues, mm-hmm. Doing work around professional learning, sometimes in very much a deficit model, though we've seen less of that, but sometimes in a much more affirmative way. And these were the people who on the 23rd of March last year took further education, adult education online. They were the brave souls who tried out things that they'd never done before, took risks, put the students absolutely first, took care of one another, looked after each other's well-being, talked about community, talked about practice of care, and taught in different ways. And many of them had not been digital pioneers before, but you know, here we are, we've got a situation. And from my observation, which is quite a broad bird's eye view, what I could see was stasis at the top of the organization, if not panic, just endless meetings talking about stuff. And then I saw this group of people, and not just doing it themselves, but taking their colleagues along with them. They were trusted to do this because actually the management hierarchy didn't particularly know what to do with them. The old systems of surveillance weren't possible. You couldn't have people doing learning walks to your classroom. I have to say it caught up pretty quickly online, but it was exhilarating in those first few weeks. And educators who had been, you know, in many cases pretty beaten down up to that point, they got a taste for what it was like to be trusted again. And it was joyful just to see people, really quite unexpected people sometimes, stepping up, trying things out, learning from each other. And then we got to a brief period in the summer where some people were starting to go back into the physical space, and there was a whole sense of let's get back to normal. Of course, that didn't happen. Happened again in September. We called it go backery. You know, that the pull of the old, which is almost irresistible, the comfort of the way we used to do things. But the way we used to do things was rubbish. It didn't serve the students. It didn't serve the staff. It served the person maybe at the top of the organization, but I'm not sure it served them, because we were having an epidemic of mental health challenges amongst leadership who were having to try and balance all of this. It's difficult to know who further education, adult education served. So that taste of trust was, I think the word I want to use is intoxicated. Despite the challenges of go backery, we're in a period now, and I am really working on this with people now, where we are thinking, okay, so what sort of service do we want to be? What sort of educators do we want to be? We've got the opportunity now with all that we've learned, and despite the go-backery, and it's all there in the theory, you know, of territorialization and re-territorialization, this endless dance between trust and control and different kinds of power. And we know now what it feels like. It's been a taste of honey. And I think, you know, we have hundreds, if not thousands, of educators now who want to continue to be risk positive. The stories we're getting back is that they are having to use their influence to keep hold of that in many places.
That's wonderful. So obviously there's been real opportunities to shine and perhaps to reinvigorate the passion that people once had when they first started out on the journey of becoming an adult educator, and the sense of community that comes from these exceptional circumstances is pretty evident.
Absolutely. This is going to be a very shallow thing to say, but I'm really active on Twitter, and I watch the UK's schools Twitter, which is, I've got some amazing practitioners, particularly around difference and diversity, that I learned so much from. And I look at FE's Twitter, and what I more see in FE's Twitter, and I know not everybody's on Twitter, I know it's not the whole world, but I see that sharing. I see that anti-competitive practice. I see people saying, oh, this is interesting. Shall we open up a thinking space around this? Yeah, I'll come. And that's happening really opportunistically, as well as in the thinking spaces that, you know, we build into the project, for example. I see projects getting less competitive because we recognise that we're all part of an ecology, we're part of a landscape of professional learning, and it is so different to how it was. People are not hoarding ideas and resources. Everyone understands that, you know, they can share their thing and still be the best person at doing them, if that makes sense. Really lovely to see. And there, in those professional learning spaces, I don't see the competitive practice. In the organizations, of course, there's still that pull. And I guess one of the palette skills, which anti-fragile skills, if you like, skills for now, is learning to actually stay with the trouble. And as Donna Haraway would say, stick with it, stick with the difficult conversations, not run away from tension within the organisation when you've got something new to bring.
Yeah. And that will be the challenge moving forward. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Christina, did you've experienced similar, you've witnessed similar outcomes?
Yeah, I think linking back to that idea that trust builds community is something that I've seen, I could see emerging from my own research, but also from our experience of doing the co-produced work together. Yep. And it's something to bear in mind is that, you know, trust is a forward-facing, I think of trust as forward-facing. So when especially we've worked in institutions for a very long time, so say you've worked in the same FE college for, you know, a number of years, and you've seen different models of leadership come and go, different faces come and go, we can almost embody that history. And I would say that the sector in the UK has had a very painful history of this drive towards competitive practice. And when we dwell on that history of low trust in our organisations, it drives us to preserve, protect our position. It can fuel suspicion in others. It can make spaces feel very unsafe. And it can make people feel like they have an inability to practice authentically. And what we're seeing through, you know, initiatives like Joy FE, through the work of the AP Connect programme that Lou's been leading, through these examples that we're seeing come out of practice, is that spaces for hope are now being created, spaces for possibility thinking.
Yep.
There's a particular article I'm thinking of, and I can't recall the author right now, but they describe trust as a leap of hope, that it's risk positive, and so it promotes collaborative working. And in my own PhD findings, I link trust to notions of thriving, transformation, unity, and optimism. And we're most likely to experience these things not only when we're rooted to our own kind of professional values, but also when we feel that those values are also shared by others. And so I think that's really emerging from what we're seeing through the projects that we're working with. And I guess as well, what I would add to that is, on an economic level, you could make this case to an organization, but also you see it coming out through these informal networks that have been created by JOY-FE and the AP Connect program, is that trust is very efficient. Distrust can drive the need to over administrate, and contracts then replace what would have been trust, you know. So it leads to excessive documentation and excessive needs for evidence, and it diverts attention away from what matters. And I think what we're seeing with this burst of enthusiasm of educators being trusted and their ability to be creative again is that their attention is being drawn towards the things that they value the most. And that is how we're seeing the benefits of trust being played out.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, it provides enormous hope. It's quite interesting to listen to these experiences. That's lovely. When we think about openness and we think about trust and we think about vulnerability, generally those values and those feelings, those emotions don't really come naturally to open up like that. And when we think about our values possibly being challenged, that can be a threatening experience at times. When we think about those issues, what are some of the challenges that educators experience when they engage with co-production research?
I would say that the values need to be established first. So in our project, but I guess you could think of this more generally, is we negotiated what values mattered the most to us as a collective in the very first meeting, and it was the first conversation that we had, were what are the values that underpin the work that we do, and what do we want to pay the most attention to as part of this project. So, you know, because it was a co-produced piece of work, that question, or the guiding question, or the guiding aspiration of the project was also determined as part of the collective, and it emerged from that discussion of our values. And I think you're absolutely right. And what, in terms of vulnerability as well, is that it's not easy to have values conversations if you're not used to having them. And Lou referenced the work of Brené Brown earlier around the idea of rumbling with vulnerability or being courageous with our vulnerability, if we're in environments which almost want to design out vulnerability, it can be very scary and threatening. But if we're in an environment which embraces vulnerability and values vulnerability, then that's where that kind of magic happens, I guess, where we start being able to share what matters to us and establish a way of working that speaks to all of us. And I don't know if Lou has anything to add to that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with all of that, Christina. And I'd add that this is a journey for educators who are used to being constrained and told what to do. So as teachers, we always like to think that once the classroom door is closed, you know, nobody interferes in that relationship. And of course, there's all sorts of interference now, whether it's as Christina says, trust is driven away and paperwork put in its place. And one of the challenges that I think educators really face is, firstly, refinding their own courage to articulate the stories of their practice, not the stories of the students. So English further education, adult education, has a tradition of like really privileging the tragic life story. And I don't mean to sound unkind, but it's where, what I mean by that is where the students, the misfortunes of the student's life, the challenges, the deprivations are actually more important than what they actually achieve, if that makes sense.
Okay.
And I've always felt uncomfortable around that. I was involved in a research project a few years ago focusing on community education, where we asked educators for the stories of their practice, and literally we didn't receive one. We'd lost the language to articulate our own practice. We could only almost martyr ourselves in the service of this social mobility story of which is quite, I find, very patronising. I'm from a working class background myself. Yeah. I'm not a tragic life story, but I could be made into one, and I'm not going to let that happen to me. So I think something about the language that is everywhere in FE, and there's an acronym for a start, means that educators have lost their voice. So FE Speak is awfully, it really is, you know, it's about delivering learning, like students are a postbox, and, you know, all of the sort of quite sort of possessive, patriarchal language, as well as the sort of marketized language. Yeah. And it's very hard to find your own vulnerability and your own values in all of that. Yeah. So one of the things that is sometimes surprising, if not shocking, to people who join the program or join one of the grassroots movements is that we don't speak like that. And what's more, we don't do all the speaking. We provide thinking spaces where you're expected to step up. Because one of the things about that sort of barriered languages, it's quite easy to be passive in that. In fact, you are rewarded for passivity. Mm-hmm. And actually we say, okay, step into the space and tell us what you think. We are listening and we will not interrupt you. This is a practice called the thinking environment that we use quite a lot in all of this work. We will not interrupt you, based on the work of Nancy Klein. And that's terrifying. It's terrifying for people. Yeah, yeah. And for many people, it reconnects them with students who are equally terrified, particularly adult learners, but not only adult learners. Our school system is not turning out young people who feel comfortable with having their own voice. So finding new and different language to be able to express the story of now, the story of values, ideas for the future, I think is a significant challenge.
So this concludes this episode of Education Transformation. Thanks so much for joining us. It's great to have you part of our audience. In the next episode, we're going to continue with Dr. Christina Donovan and Dr. Lou Mycroft as they unpack further the importance of trust within faculty relationships.